Welcome back. I'm Jesse Baines with Yahoo Finance. You're watching Editor's Edition. And believe it or not, this is our season finale talking about real estate. Never mind succession. Make sure you watch this. This is the season finale to watch. We'll be taking your questions. We'll be talking about policy. We're going to polish our crystal balls, all that and more with Realosophy Realty's John Pasalis in Toronto. Thanks for being here, John.
Thanks for having me again.
And we have Steve Suretsky in Vancouver. Thanks for joining us, Steve.
Yeah, thanks for having me. It's a season finale, not the series finale. So,
right, did I say series finale? I meant to say season
finale.
No,
you did. You said season.
Okay, good. Yeah, you had me there. I thought we were going to have to redo that all over again. Anyways, let's start with a Toronto update. Prices, sales seem to be booming. John, what are we seeing compared to the last time we talked?
I mean, it's unreal. I feel like every you know talk we have, the market keeps getting hotter, which is hard to believe because it's already unbelievably hot. I mean, low-rise houses are on average pushing about 1.5 million. Condos are over 700,000. We have less than a month of inventory for houses and for condos. Like that is such an unbelievably competitive market. And you know, people are seeing it on the ground. There's bidding wars everywhere. The condo market's hot, low rise market's hot. It's very competitive.
Okay. So if you were to advise a client, do you think it's going to get any better in 2022, John? Would you wait? Would you tell them to wait?
No, I mean, I don't think it's by better. I mean, you mean better for buyers? Probably not. I mean, the reality is usually the most competitive months of the year, you know, people think it's the spring market like April and May, because those usually have the most sales. But the reality is usually the most competitive months are actually January, February and early March, because that's when most buyers jump into the market to buy a home in the spring. But there's the fewest number of listings because, I mean, not a lot of people are listing in January, February. So it's probably going to continue to be super competitive in January, February. So I don't think things are going to get kind of better for buyers anytime soon, you know, unless there's some kind of big policy change that takes some investors out of the market to take some of the pressure off. But I don't see anything that's going to cool the market anytime soon.
So you say January, February, you know, you're looking for it to be hot, but are people not sort of not into going out in the snow and the freezing cold and dealing with that kind of stuff? Does that not turn people off?
No, I mean, definitely not. I mean, and certainly this time of year around December over the holidays, people hit pause. But, you know, early January, early February, no, the snow doesn't prevent people. You know, again, like I said, that's usually when most people jump into the market to buy a home in the spring. So you have still a ton of buyers and usually not a lot to look at, which is why even in a normal year, like pre-COVID, the months where homes would get like 20 plus offers were usually January, February, March, you know, not April, May, June, even though there were technically more sales in April, May, June. So I think it's going to continue to be pretty competitive in the first quarter of this year for sure.
Interesting. Okay, Steve, what is, I know we've often discovered that Vancouver and Toronto tend to mirror each other. Is that the case in December?
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say to John's point, nothing seems to slow Canadians' lust for housing. You know, what we're seeing in Vancouver, again, it's a broken record, similar story. It feels like since the last time we talked, the market took another leg higher, at least for certain segments of the market. So like, again, entry level, single family detached house. I mean, honestly, it's like a bloodbath out there for buyers. You know, if you look at the numbers, if you talk to anyone last November, the market was extremely tight for detached housing. You know, the inventory since then is down 25% year over year. There's really like zero, there's almost like nothing on the market right now. For single family detached house, you know, you're under 2 months of inventory on the market. And we've seen prices just move even higher in the last sort of 4 to 5 weeks. Basically what's happening is like there's basically no listings coming to market, and so every buyer shows up at the same house and you end up with 6, 7, 8, 10, 15, 20 offers on a house. And it's getting to the point now where, you know, maybe it's a little bit counterintuitive to maybe what John said, is I start to think that at some point we're going to reach this exhaustion level where people just get so fed up and so distraught with the market, they just kind of put their plans on pause. And so I don't necessarily think that it'll be, it needs a policy change to slow the market. I always look back to Vancouver in the spring of 2016, you know, the market just kind of stopped moving higher in March of 2016. And there was no reason behind it. And then of course, you know, 4 or 5 months later, we brought in the foreign buyers tax here. And that kind of was the final nail in the coffin, so to speak. So I don't know, I'm kind of watching it. I think that there's still segments of the market that are arguably, I think, going to move higher. I look at the condo market and say, okay, is it going to be a similar pattern where eventually house prices top out detached, and then the condos, which have been lagging, do those start to then run up in 2022? I don't know, but I think that's certainly likely.
Okay, I don't know is not a good enough answer around here, so you can know that. So it's crystal ball time. It's time to put you on the spot. Time for a bold call, Steve. What do you expect to see in 2022?
I mean, I've been writing about it in my monthly reports there. I do think that the condo market, if you look at the underlying data, I do think that you're going to see the quote unquote, the rotation, where I think that the condo market will outperform the detached housing market in 2022, simply on the basis that what happens is, again, similar to 2016-17, was people eventually just get priced out of detached houses, and that money starts to trickle down. And we've already seen that trickle down in the townhouse market. And I think as people get priced out of that, it ultimately trickles down to the condo market. And that's, I think, what we're going to see in the year ahead.
Okay. John, you have talked about what you expect to see in January and February, the early part of 2022. But as a whole, what do you see happening?
Yeah, I mean, I think, and I tend to agree with Steve, I don't know if we need a big policy change to cool the market. I mean, he's 100% right that we could hit this point where buyer fatigue kicks in. And I think if anything, we might see the market certainly maybe cool down in the second half of the year. Partly it could be a policy change. Partly it could be, as Steve said, just buyer fatigue. You know, prices just hit this point where buyers think, I want out of the market. And we kind of saw that in 2017 when prices fell in York Region and the suburbs in Toronto. There wasn't a recession. It's just buyers said, I'm sick of this. And they just pulled out of the market. And I think those changes are the hardest to predict, because it's like trying to predict mass, you know, human behavior at one point when people just get fed up, right? And it's impossible to predict, but it's certainly, that's one trend we got to keep an eye on. You know, if rates go up, credits tighten on investors, that could take some demand out of the market. So, but I don't think we're going to see any slight cooling probably till the second half of next year.
Could I just add an anecdote to John's point?
Yeah, please.
So just to give the viewers kind of one example, was like, I just had a listing more recently, single family, you know, detached house in the suburbs, which is what everybody wants. So, you know, we list this house at 1.4, which is kind of like a threshold for that local market. You end up with 12 offers in this house. Basically, like 8 of the 12 came in pretty much at the asking price of 1.4, and they all called and said, well, this is all my buyer can qualify for. They can't qualify for anymore, so hopefully you can pick us, blah, blah, blah. I mean, the house ends up going for 1.6 because you have like two or three of those 12 offers that just push the price up. But you had 8 of them that didn't qualify for more than 1.4. So I always look at it and say, well, if the neighbor's house now goes on and list their house next week, they're probably going to base their listing price on what I just sold that house for at 1.6. And I think that buyer pool starts to shrink and shrink. And, you know, in Greater Vancouver, the benchmark price for a detached house now is basically 1.9 million. So that's something I'm kind of keeping an eye on.
Okay, that's a good trend to watch for. Thanks. This kind of all has me wondering, we've talked about listings a lot. There's nothing out there to buy. Do you think there's a bit of a vicious cycle going on now? For say somebody wants to, they're thinking about selling their house and moving, but they see Yahoo Finance articles saying that, you know, there's listings are at record lows in inventory and there's nothing to buy, yada yada. But then they think to themselves, well, I'm not going to sell. I can easily sell. but I can't find anything to buy, so I'm just going to stay tight. And people are reluctant to put their homes on the market because the move into the next house is going to be that much more difficult. Do you think that's keeping sellers on the sidelines, John?
I mean, certainly. I mean, I think it's a tough market to compete in. So, you know, moving up, even if you own an existing home, it's not a fun market to get into. You know, on the listing side in Toronto, it's an interesting story because when we actually look at the data, new listings are actually up over last year, about 8%. The reason there's nothing to choose from is because demand has significantly outpaced new listings. Like demand, like number of sales are up over 20% year over year, which has basically absorbed any of that increase. And there's basically nothing on the market now to choose from. So it definitely makes it hard even for move up buyers when they basically see how competitive the market is. Some are taking advantage of the lower rates and getting in, but some are certainly still sitting on the sidelines.
Okay. Are you seeing a similar trend, Steve?
I mean, I think new listings here have still been pretty tight. I mean, the condo market has actually had a lot of new listings above normal, but the demand, we've had record condo sales. So that's kind of kept inventory actually falling. You know, I think condo inventory dropped like 40%, even though new listings are still running above historical norms. So that kind of shows you where the demand, how you can see the demand picking up in that space. I think there is, like, to John's point, I think that, and I think we've talked about this before, is that you do have people that they don't want to move because they look and say, oh gosh, like there's nothing to buy out there. And it looks so competitive. Like I'm just going to hold and wait this thing out. And I think you definitely have a lot of people waiting till the spring now because like there's no inventory to pick from. I think the other thing I'd kind of pinpoint, at least in this market, I don't know, maybe if John can touch on Toronto, but what we're seeing is there's kind of like an arbitrage in the market right now. What you're seeing is like all the demand and all the pressure is at the entry level single family detached space. So like, you know, in Vancouver, for example, like if you stick under $2.5 million, the market is so incredibly hot. You're going to be competing with minimum 5, 6, 7 offers. But now if you go into, you know, north of 3.5, north of 4 million, the market is slow. Like you can kind of, so you can almost just, you could sell your house in one area, your entry level house for 2.5, then go move up to a $3.5 million house and have almost no competition. So it's kind of interesting, like that high end of the market, unlike 2016-17, is actually quite flat.
Interesting. So the well-heeled buyers are okay, aren't doing so bad if they want to make a move. I want to get to questions so we don't run out of time. We want to work through the queue. These are the last five on the year, so hopefully we get through these before we start. Steve, I forgot to mention, one of the questions said, if Steve could throw in an quote, and you've got to laugh at the end of your answer. So feel free, if you do see opportunity, to use that line. There seems to be a demand among the viewers to hear it. But anyways, let's begin with Harris. Now, Harris has a question about a situation that we talked about last show, builders jacking up prices. Here's Harris's situation. My brother and I bought a pre-construction condo townhouse in February this year for $860,000. We already put down $86,000 deposit as scheduled. However, we just received a notice from the builder saying that the project has been changed and we either sign a new contract with a special price of $1.2 million, otherwise sign back a mutual release. Harris is frustrated, as you can imagine, you know, saying, what's the point of buying a future contract? What advice can you provide, John?
I mean, unfortunately, like there's not a lot of advice. Like the best advice is, you know, if you buy from a very good, reputable builder, good longstanding builders, I mean, try not to do those things because obviously it's not great for their reputation. But some builders are just going to take advantage of rising home prices, basically cancel their project or change them materially to make, you know, an extra $400,000 basically on a property or $300,000. So the challenge is when you're buying pre-construction, you kind of don't have much control. I mean, the contracts are written to protect the builders and builders can make these changes, you know, especially if they struggle getting financing because costs have changed, they could cancel the deal. And that's just unfortunately one of the risks that buyers take on when they're buying a pre-construction property.
Steve, what would you tell Harris to do to try to figure out a way to come up with the money, the difference, and keep the home that he has purchased, or walk away?
Call a lawyer. No, I mean,
that's good advice, actually.
I think it's honestly, it's obviously, you know, disappointing to hear stories like this. Like, you never like to see people get taken advantage of. I mean, we've talked about it on the show, but I think the biggest thing is finding, I see a lot of buyers, particularly new buyers, is they just walk into sales centers unrepresented and just assume the developer, because it's a flashy sales center, the developer's, you know, going to look out for their best interests. But like, the developer's there to make money and protect their best interests. And so you kind of have to have proper representation on the other side. And what that looks like is, you know, having somebody vet developers for you. Like, if you've been in the industry for 10 plus years and you know all the builders in the area, like, you have to be very selective of builders that you ultimately buy from, particularly in a market today where you're seeing rising costs of materials and construction, and developers are trying to take back some of those profits. So like John said, the good reputable developers do not do that. And so I think it's important just to look out for those moving forward.
Yeah. It's interesting in my area, I'm in the Peel region, just half an hour away from Toronto, but anytime there's a phase release for a new project, a new development of homes, there's lineups down the street. It's like people are lining up to buy concert tickets or something. It's unreal. And I hope that these people are paying close attention to these contracts and realizing the risks after some of these stories are coming to light, and really pay attention to what's going on, because they could find themselves in a similar situation. I want to move on to Rob now. Rob has a question about rental, the rental market. As a committed long-term renter, I follow the rental market closely. What's the most reliable source of rental data for households in Vancouver, Toronto, Canada, that households are actually paying versus the advertised rental rate market that landlords hope to get? So, I don't know if such a resource exists, John, but do you have any recommendations for Rob?
So yeah, I mean, at least in Toronto, there's no great data source for rentals in purpose-built rental buildings, because those are just whatever the company that owns them wants to rent. But what you can find is data on, for example, condominium rents and house rents. Those are usually listed on the MLS. You can go to our website, velocity.com, log in, and you'll basically see every rental transaction for a condominium, every rental transaction for a house, what it was listed for, what it rented for. And at a minimum, that'll give you a good sense of the market for condos and for houses. And then obviously, if you're looking at like a purpose-built rental, those are going to rent for a little bit less than condominiums. But I'd say that's probably the only source that I could think of where you can actually get a lot of rental data.
Okay, great. That's very helpful. Steve, is there a resource for somebody in the Vancouver area?
No, it's not very good. We don't have very good rental data here. Certainly don't go to CMHC. They're probably the worst. You get a lot of people in Vancouver that rely on Craigslist, which again, I know sounds like we're back in the early 2000s, but that's just kind of, our rental market isn't properly serviced in Vancouver, unfortunately. To Toronto's point, we just brought in MLS listings for rental properties. So we're starting to get a little bit of data filtering through where you can actually see where condos are actually renting for, but you're kind of relying on which landlords or property managers actually list their properties on the MLS system. So unfortunately, as a renter, there's not a great deal of in-depth data here.
Okay, thank you. And now let's move on to Joe. Joe is also a buyer of a pre-construction home. He says, my builder says the optional cold seller may have been missed when selecting options in the purchase and sale agreement. Builder wants to charge $4,000 now. Is this normal and is this worth paying for? John.
I mean, yes, interestingly enough.
Builders are acting up lately.
Builders try to squeeze any penny they can. And it's kind of funny. I mean, the cold seller usually is just the area under the front porch, which, you know, just basically finishing it usually just involves just putting a door into the basement. So it's not a big expense, but, you know, they're just trying to squeeze whatever costs they can. You know, is it worth doing? I mean, possibly, because the flip side is, if you say no and you try to do it yourself, sometimes they actually backfill those things with dirt. So, you know, doing it manually after the fact is not going to be a fun job. So, I mean, I'd probably pay the $4,000 to get it done.
Oh, my goodness. In a competitive market, though, Steve, I mean, this is an unfinished business, a business basement. Is not having a cold cellar going to make any real difference to when if you wanted to sell it, let's say, in the value of the home?
I was going to say,
that doesn't happen, right? Like,
I don't even know what the heck a cold cellar is. Those things don't exist in Vancouver, man.
Right, because you guys don't have basements in most of your homes, right?
Certain areas there's basements. There's some, like, I grew up in Richmond, obviously. We're like below sea level, so you certainly don't want to have a basement there.
So our cold cellar, yeah, just for your information and everybody else's, is we just use it to put dishes and pots and pans. We've never actually used it for anything meaningful. You're supposed to put food in there, but we have an expansive dish collection that apparently needs to be used at some point in our lives, and we have to store it with care. But anyway, Steve,
continue. That's a wild concept. Yeah, it just it's completely over my head.
Okay, let's move on then. The next question comes to us from Lisa. Lisa asks, does it even make financial sense to renovate, upgrade before selling, considering how hot the market has been? John?
Yes and no. I mean, you certainly, when you're selling, you don't want to spend money on a new kitchen. Like, you're not going to spend $30,000-$40,000 on a new kitchen or a new bathroom or do major renos. But to do minor renos that takes like an older looking kitchen and spruces it up and, you know, painting cabinets, changing countertops, small things like that, usually we would recommend doing, you know, especially if the home feels like it needs a reno, you can do small touch-ups that add significant value. So there are definitely small renos and improvements, but not a full renovation. You don't get every dollar back when you renovate usually. So it's usually not worth the investment.
Okay, well, now I feel kind of lied to, because I'm a big fan of Love It or List It, and I see they spend like $60,000 to upgrade the house, and boom, boom, the new value is $120,000 more. All these TV shows. Okay. Steve, what would you advise clients based on how the Vancouver market's looking? Would you do anything to the house or just sell it as is?
I mean, I usually just advise people to do the obvious stuff, which is like, where are you gonna get the biggest ROI, which is like, you know, you throw in a clean coat of paint on there, you know, maybe you replace some of the carpets if they're kind of old or whatever, like just basic stuff, right? I mean, and don't get me wrong, if somebody wants to do a more extensive renovation, it's just a matter of like how much you're gonna spend into it to actually get out, right? I mean, like if you go, there's certainly money to be made in terms of like, people are paying a premium right now for, you know, nicely updated move-in ready homes. But it's just a matter of like, do you want to spend, you know, 4 months doing a complete overhaul of a renovation to, you know, like how much is your time worth as well, right? So it's not for the faint of heart.
Okay. Next question comes to us from Mark. Mark asks, we would like to tap into the value of our home, but don't want to move out, especially since the market is so competitive right now. So it's interesting. These themes that we discussed are coming through in the questions. The market is so competitive now. What is your view on reverse mortgages for retirees like us? John, what's your take?
Yeah, I mean, I think...
Well, wait for the reverse... saw. Is that a saw above your head? Are you doing renovations to your office as we speak, John?
Anyways, no, okay. That's not
We're
me.
Clear. We're clear. Go ahead.
I mean, tapping into the equity of one's home is definitely a common trend. I mean, you know, I think the key thing is, and I can't say I've looked at reverse mortgages specifically, but, you know, there's different ways to do it. I mean, you can kind of take a home equity line of credit out of your property and tap into that when you need it as well. So, you know, depending on how much capital you want, certainly it's worth doing. I mean, you obviously don't want to take too much, but, you know, for some people who are retiring and don't want to move out and want a little bit of extra money in the short term, certainly why not? I mean, a lot of people are doing this, taking money out of their homes to help their kids, you know, with a down payment. So, you know, why not invest it in your own lifestyle is sort of the flip side. So I don't think it's a terrible idea. Certainly not.
Okay, Steve, what's your view on reverse mortgages for retirees like Mark?
I think that the terms don't tend to be overly favorable. I think that they tend to favor the, I don't know too much about them. I just know that the rates tend to be on the higher side. And I think what happens is a lot of people get sold a product that they don't necessarily understand. And so they tend to see their equity sort of drain away over time. So similar to John's point, you know, traditional refinance might potentially make more sense.
Yeah. And it's interesting, there's the marketing push behind reverse mortgages. Here we have ads. I don't want to keep harping on TV shows. It's like I sit around and just watch TV all day long. But, we have in Canada, Kurt Browning, one of Canada's sweethearts is endorsing reverse mortgages. And in the US, we have Tom Selleck, who looks into the camera and says, look, I wouldn't lie to you. I wouldn't push a product on you that isn't in your best interest and that eventually involves you losing your home. But as you guys said, just look at all the fine print and all the information and make sure it's the right decision for you. And that amazingly is all the questions. We've gone through the queue now. So if you have new questions, send them on through. John and Steve will answer them on an upcoming episode. So we have a little bit of time left. Let's talk a little bit about this new variant. It's still early days. We have no idea how this is going to play out. But do you expect, I'm hearing that a lot of offices are kind of pushing back their return to office plans. Do we expect something of a repeat of the early days when people were like, we're not going back to the office. Let me find something in the suburbs and push suburban prices up a bit. Steve, what do you think?
Yeah, I think that, again, whether you agree or disagree with how, governments might handle or react to it, I think we're kind of leaning towards that direction of, employers, opting to hold people at home. And so I think this kind of delays the recovery for segments of the market, like the downtown condo market. I think this might delay that recovery. I think that, when you see new variants and whatnot, I think that just, in my opinion, just remains bullish for the suburban single family house. I think it's kind of just keeps going with the status quo, right? So until we sort of move on and move past this, I think that's when you'll start to maybe see a shift in the market where the downtown market, for example, outperforms the detached in the suburbs.
John, what's your view? Bullish for places like Bancroft and Scugog and Brantford, or even, the 905? Do you see any sort of trend shift? A reversion back to the original trends.
I don't think it's going to be anything like the first time we were locked down and everyone just fled the city. I mean, the other challenge is today, we're kind of 2 years into this, and Bancroft and Scugog, all of these outer areas have like nearly doubled in price, right? And they're significantly more expensive. Like one of the reasons why they were so attractive in the early days of COVID is because they're so much cheaper, right? Whereas today they're not that, not as affordable as they were. So I don't know if we're going to see as big of a rush out. I mean, I think that trend for detached still exists and the suburbs are certainly still busier than downtown. And I think that'll continue, but I don't think this new variant is going to bring the massive new wave because it's so expensive to buy in the suburbs right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then to your point,
I'd like to add to that. Go ahead. To that point, I still think it's like bullish for the suburban detached, but in no ways am I advocating for someone to go out there and buy it so they can flip it for more money in 12 months. Because similar, to John's point, I mean, the prices that people are paying in the suburbs right now are extremely stretched. And so I definitely have some concerns there, right? If you look at in Greater Vancouver, suburbs, let's say condo prices, for example, in the suburbs are up 30%. I mean, they're flat to down in downtown Vancouver. So you got like a 30 to 35% spread in some of these markets right now. So there's pockets of excess overvaluation and pockets where I would argue that are undervalued.
Mm-hmm. And to just to the point of bankrupt. I was just kind of curious and did a little bit of a dig. And the average price, despite the rise, is still only about $450,000 based on the most recent data. So I can't even imagine the steals of deals people were getting before the prices shot up. And the price is shooting up. If one had bought a home in Bancroft at the beginning of the year, that as an investor, let's say, compared to somebody who had bought shares in Amazon, Shopify, as well as Suncor, which has rallied with oil prices, Bancroft wins. You would have made more money on that Bancroft home. It's been a crazy year. I want to thank you guys so much for helping guide the viewers through these markets. I've learned a ton. I'm sure the viewers have learned a lot too. So thank you. Happy holidays. Happy New Year. And meanwhile, do check out John and Steve on Twitter. Thanks, John.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
Thank you to you, Steve. Happy holidays.
Happy holidays. Thanks for having me on. This has been a great show, great year. So looking forward to next year.
Yeah, me too. Meanwhile, do check back with Yahoo Finance Canada for all your news on real estate, stock markets, cryptocurrencies, the energy markets, you name it. See you next year.